My name is Gisla. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 12th, 1999. But as I like to say usually, is I got sober sometime in the last century. I like that much better than 1999. It makes me look better. So I do have a home group. I'm currently, I'll tell you about this, but I'm currently in the process of moving from Minneapolis in the United States, where I've been for the last 8 years, and to a small town just south of the Arctic Circle called Akureyri in Iceland. So that's interesting. I do have a sponsor, and as I said, I do have a home group. My home group is kind of still called Foundation Stone. It's in Minneapolis in Minnesota. It's on Friday nights. So if you ever go to Minneapolis, look it up, Foundation Stone Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. As you have probably guessed, my name, Gisli, means a ray of light in Icelandic, right? You knew that already. you can just sense it. And the reason why I am here is that I don't want to drink again. That's the reason why I'm here. You know, I just don't want to drink again. I did not have time to come to Copenhagen at this. I'm moving from one continent to a small island, and I'm starting two new jobs and finishing up two old jobs and getting my three kids situated in school. And I still came, not because I like to sacrifice myself. I do not, and I don't do that. But because I know from experience nothing really works on me as well as spending time with other alcoholics and trying to be useful. I started drinking, and I started drinking when I was about 12, 13 years old. And as I often explain, I did not have to work to get my physical allergy started at all. So there are three parts of this illness, right, discussed in the big book. The physical allergy, the mental obsession, and the spiritual malady. And the physical allergy, for me, it was something I was blessed with. And it was there full force, waiting in a cage someplace for me to open up for it. I did not have to feed it much or cultivate it at all. It was just out when it was out. There was no waiting around. And there was not a lot of cultivating it. The first time I drank, it was bad, but it was still good, you know. And the big book talks about the physical allergy and the phenomenon of craving. And the phenomenon of craving is not something that happens before I drink. That's called the obsession of the mind. The phenomenon of craving is something that kicks in once alcohol hits my brain, you know. And so the phenomenon of craving, what we all have in common with the phenomenon of craving, is that when I start drinking, I can't control it. So I can't control it. If I can't control it, it's never fun, and it never lasts for a long time. So when I can control my drinking, it's never fun, and it never lasts. It's always followed by a worse relapse than before. And I say this because I had a weekend, beautiful weekend, in beautiful Lund, Sweden, where I controlled my drinking for 7 days. And that's what I think about. Well, I didn't really control it. I lost control a little bit, but not really horribly, you know. I wasn't arrested or anything like that. So for me, I always had those 7 days in Sweden where I didn't mess up the drinking. And in my experience, we all have our 7 days in Sweden. You know, we all have that time. Oh, there was this magical time when I just controlled completely, you know. And that's what I tried to seek. And so the big book talks about chasing that illusion to the gates of insanity and death. So I can't really control my drinking. So I have that. And once I started drinking, that started to happen right away. There was no waiting for it. Another thing that they talk about in the big book is that alcohol has an effect on us alcoholics that's different from the effects it has on other people. Now, alcohol is a depressant. It makes people calm and relaxed. For me, it does something magical. And what's magical about it for me is it gets me present. It gets me to the here and now. You know? It's an artificial here and now, but still, it's a here and now where I'm not thinking about how I feel. I'm not thinking about what will go wrong tomorrow. I'm not thinking about this awkward thing I said 3 months ago. You know, because that's a big thing of what I did from when I was a little child. Part of probably my spiritual malady is that I ruminated a lot. I would replay things and then I would, I shouldn't have said that. And then I would be sitting on the bus and actually speaking out loud to myself. Shut up, you know. And don't have a diagnosable mental illness, I don't think, except alcoholism. But still, that's the way I was and still am if I don't take care of myself. Anyway, alcohol does something for me, and I think it's important to include that in the definition of the illness. Alcoholism does something for me that just works better on life than for other people. You know, alcoholism fits a lock in my brain that's just unique. It does something magical to me. And trying to identify with somebody who's not an alcoholic, trying to explain the ease and comfort that comes with not the first drink, maybe third or fourth drink. I don't know why they say first drink. But that feeling that came over me, if I could get that without any bad consequences, I would do that every day. And like people say, if I wasn't an alcoholic, I would be drunk every day. You know, because alcohol just does an awesome thing for me. It really does. The problem is, I have, and I was telling the guys in the man strip about this, but I have some bonus features to my physical allergy. So I have the allergy, but then it's like a 2-for-1 deal. I have some other things going on as well when I drink that some alcoholics do have and some don't, you know. And so what usually happens to me, or what used to happen to me, is I go into blackouts. And when I go into blackouts, I do things that I would under normal circumstances never do. And I wouldn't believe them unless people had some sort of evidence to tell me that I had did them. And sometimes that was necessary. For me, it was just a matter of time. Starting drinking 12, 13. When I was 15 years old, I first tried getting drunk 3 days at a row. It was magical. Magical. Do you know what the cure for hangover is? It's more alcohol. Why did nobody tell me this before? I had to wait until I was 15 to find that out? What a raw deal. This should be on the label of every alcohol bottle in the country. Cure for hangover, more alcohol. Anyway, that was kind of a big thing for me, drinking 3 days in a row. It was 4 days in a row, actually. Drinking 4 days in a row and kind of getting to that point. And then when I was 16, I was taken home in a police car 3 weekends in a row. And that was also a big thing for me. It was like a milestone. Woohoo! 3 weekends in a row in a police car. Woohoo! I was kind of into drinking. You know, I thought it was cool. When I was 16, I woke up and I had urinated myself. And that was also a big step for me. I was like, yes! Woken up and I pissed my pants. Woohoo! So that was a big deal for me too. This was the value system I had. Yeah, I was very good. Kind of, I was subtly proud of it. Do you know what I mean? I was like, oh, I guess I'm a real drinker now, you know? And yeah, not too bad. So a lot of course this happened. I was a teenager and a lot of it had to do with my mom, and you know, a lot of the drinking and a lot of the consequences had to do with stuff happening with my mom and people telling me probably from when I was about 15 that I just should not drink alcohol. I mean, just random people were telling me that, you know, coming up to me in school and saying, Geesley, you probably shouldn't drink. I mean, that doesn't really happen to normal people, I found out later. Do you know what I mean? Like just random people that they hardly know saying, oh yeah, you probably shouldn't drink, you know? But when I was 18, I did a serious enough thing that I decided to stop drinking, okay? And without going into too much detail, I nearly killed myself and a few other people. And I could not recall any of it. That's very scary. I mean, I was under the impression that I was a nice guy, you know? And even though I went into blackouts, I just believed when I was in a blackout, I was just being a nice guy, but just couldn't remember being a nice guy, right? But at that time, I had very documented evidence that I was not such a nice guy when I drank alcohol. I get a complete character change. And they talk about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in the Big Book and, you know, two separate persons, and that's what happens to me. You know, we talked about earlier in the meeting, Morton the mechanic talked about hiding the car keys, right? You know, and that's the same thing I did. You know, what a cunning plan. Like I wouldn't find them. Like somebody else hit them. But still, that's the idea, right? I had the idea that it wasn't me who was going to show up later that night. So that's why I could hide the car keys from that dude. Do you know what I mean? Because it was another dude. It wasn't me. It was, you know, and I had no idea about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and what the Big Book says about that. Come on in. But still, I was convinced that this was a whole nother person, you know. It wasn't me somehow. And so that's what happens. I'm a scared guy. I'm a fairly sensitive guy. I am, no matter what I thought when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am not a tough guy. Especially after being in the United States for 8 years, sponsoring different guys there, I know I am not a tough guy. I am just a big softy. I've sponsored some tough guys now. I know how they look like. They usually have a lot of tattoos and ankle bracelets. Donated from the government. So, I heard that story, by the way. inside joke here. Which, by the way, tells a lot about the men's community here that I've been here 3 days and I'm in on inside jokes. Isn't that awesome? So, I drink in a way that after a certain period, I am not the same person anymore. And what's even worse, that I can't remember what the other person does. That's totally insane. If anything else would do that to a person, there would be no doubt in anybody's mind, you should not do that. Like, let's say every time I ate peanuts, I would change personalities and go on some sort of a crime spree, people would not be like thinking, oh, maybe you should just eat peanuts with ice cream, you know, or some shit like that. They would just say, stay away from peanuts, man. You know, it's not good for you. With alcohol, there are, you know, people are more kind of like ambivalent sometimes about that. But it was pretty clear at the time when I was 18 that I had something called a physical allergy to alcohol, right? And that's what the Big Book talks about. They say physical allergy. It has nothing to do with the immune system. Okay? It has to do with the abnormal reaction of the body to a foreign substance. That's what we mean when we say allergy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a body that reacts abnormally to alcohol. We can all agree, I think. You know? This is not normal. So, I remember I was 18... a young, intelligent man. I was a lot into sports. I have also another insanity, which is called being a goalie in team handball. It has not been fixed, and the steps don't help with that either. I just never stopped doing that. And I always did well in school. Everything went well for me, except this thing with alcohol. So when I decided to stop drinking, it was so easy. I remember I showed up in court, and I said, here's a receipt from the alcohol counselor, and I also went to AA, and I've started paying for the damages, and I'm just not going to drink anymore. And it was so simple for me, you know. I was, oh, okay, it was just like a lesson learned. Do you know what I mean? Like, okay, I'm a guy who can't drink. I even used the word allergy, although I was a couple of years away from being in AA. I still was at that point where I just say, I can't drink. And everybody agreed. Do you know what I mean? And so the thing I did was kind of a big deal. So the family knew. And do you know what I mean? And it came, you know, there was a little news story written about it. And so it was, you know, my 15 minutes of fame. There is a difference between being famous and infamous, but that's a different story. I stopped drinking. It was so simple. 6 weeks pass, and I'm drunk again. And I can't understand what happened. Just can't understand what happened. And I quit again. 4 weeks pass. I drink again. And I'm like, what the heck is this? Then 3 weeks, 2 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, 2 weeks. And I went on like this for about 18 months, trying to stop, really trying. I mean, this was official. Do you know what I mean? This was a secret thing. Trying to get the help I could, trying not to drink. And I just couldn't stay sober. Just could not stay sober. This part in Alcoholics Anonymous we call the obsession of the mind. And it's not the obsession to count lines in the sidewalk or the leaves on the trees or obsession towards, you know, women or cleaning your hands a lot. Those are separate illnesses. but it's an obsession of the mind. It's the illusion that I can drink again. Or another way to put it, I have this insanity to believe that it's a good idea that I should drink again. And in these, and I did this, this was about, 2 years, 18 months, trying to not to, and then 6 months after that, just not even trying, not even caring, knowing I didn't have a chance. And in these 2 years, I had all kinds of different excuses not to drink. And then I had all that I tried to make up. I can't drink because of this or that, but it was always the same thing. I just knew I couldn't handle it. I knew I couldn't. But in those 2 years, I also came up with new excuses to drink again and again and again. Sometimes it was because once it was because a girlfriend broke up with me. Once it was because I went to a birthday party, Once it was because I got paid. Once because I didn't get paid. Once because, everything was so horrible that I could just as well kill myself. Well, since I was going to kill myself, I could drink first, right? That's okay. Yeah. So that happened 3 times, 4 times. I used that one. And I told this story in the retreat as well, but it just exemplifies well how my drinking was. That once, when I was about 20, I went out into the countryside after finishing my... Do you have students' prof here? What do you do between 16 and 20 in school? What's that called?
Drinking.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yep. Say again? Yeah, gymnasium. So after my gymnasium test, where I did drink a lot afterwards, I decided to go into the countryside. I didn't even show up for graduation. I was very serious, something. I just made a mess like I always do when I drink. It was worse because I was in a silly costume making a lot of mess. So I decided I'm quitting again. So I put an ad in the paper for farmers in Iceland. And I've picked the most remote place that answered the ad. Because I was going to talk to nature, be one with nature, right? And I was not going to drink again. And when they hired me, I presented myself, of course, as very capable. And I said, yes, and I don't drink. Yes, I don't drink at all. That stuff just doesn't agree with me. I can't do it. And the reason why I was going there was so he wouldn't drink. And so it all went really well. I conversed with nature, and we built a barn there, and it was super fun, and it was Iceland in the summertime, very beautiful. And then about 4 weeks into it, 3-4 weeks into it, something like that, we finished cementing the floor on the barn, and we had a little party because a lot of people came to help. And somebody handed me something, and I just took it. I just drank it, and I didn't think. And like I said over the weekend, there was no fight. There was no dramatic thing, I just took it because somebody handed it to me. And I went there specifically in the middle of nowhere. It was not a fun place to be honest, not at all. And I went there specifically, didn't do graduation, didn't do anything like that, not to drink because of how I drink. But then I don't even think about taking another drink. And that's the obsession of the mind. It gets me. You know, and sometimes I think the solution to the obsession is not having a job so I can't get fired, right? Or not having a girlfriend so she can't dump me or whatever. But whatever, or not going to work as a farmhand so we never stop, you know, so we never cement floors so nobody hands, do you know what, hands me alcohol. It just, those solutions never worked for me because those weren't my issues. My issue, my problem was the obsession of the mind, you know? I cannot fight it, you know. It eats me up, and it doesn't even stop to digest, you know. I have no chance against this obsession. It gets me every time, and I think, because I think I'm super smart, of course, I think that'll help me, but it just uses that against me. You know, both the fact that I think I'm smart, and even if I am smart, it still uses that against me. You know, and it's fun to talk to alcoholics now who think they're smart. Because their reasons for drinking, they're always just more complicated than the other person's reasons for to drink still. But it's still just an excuse, right? You know. So for me, all of these reasons I had for those 2 years to drink, they had nothing to do with anything except my obsession of the mind. It will give me a reason to drink. There is no arguing with it. There is no being prepared for the argument that it will bring. You know, oh, if the obsession says this, I'm going to say this. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm fighting myself. No, it already knows my next move, and it will beat me every time. And it took me about 2 years to accept defeat towards the obsession of the mind. Now, if I was not a real alcoholic, I could have stopped drinking when I was 18. Right? Just say no would have worked for me, but it didn't. That makes me an alcoholic. So, and I always get a little, when people say, and I remember when I came to the United States first time, and as I said, I don't know if I said it, but I spent, so from 2006 to just this August in the United States, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and when people in the States would say, if you are a real alcoholic, and I was like, shit, real alcoholic, what does that mean? Do you know what I, did you then kill 10 people, steal a bus, and drive to Mexico? Or what does a real alcoholic mean? Well, a real alcoholic, according to the big book, has nothing to do with the stuff you do. Those are just symptoms of it. You know, some of us have horrible alcoholism sitting on our couch for 15 years. You know, never going out. Never showing the kind of get up and go that I used to show when I was drinking. It does not make people more or less alcoholic, you know. Two things make us alcoholic according to the big book. Physical allergy towards alcohol. When I drink, I have no control over it. If I have control, it is not fun and it does not last. That's one. Two, obsession of the mind. If I stop drinking, I can't stay stopped. My mind will tell me it's a good idea to drink for any number of reasons within a certain number of times. You know, usually it's within a few months. For me, it was, I never got more than, you know, 6 weeks. But so that having those two things makes me a real alcoholic. You know, it's not about anything else than those two things. And I go through this regularly with myself. I check in, you know, because I need to rework my first step as well. But basically for me, my first step is just acknowledging those two things. Now, my drinking, I used to idolize certain things, and I used to idolize drinking, you know. Drinking to me was a religion. I had a lot of friends who used to use drugs, for example. At that time, amphetamines and cocaine was very, you know, big in Iceland, you know, and some of my friends used that. For me, that was just ridiculous. I felt they were amateurs using drugs like that, because I could get all that I needed out of alcohol, you know. And for me, the people who are using drugs were just idiots. You know, they were in the tight t-shirts with the blonde hair and do boof, 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 whatever, you know. It's just, I was way above that, you know. I drank alcohol. Now, that was my thing, you know. And I got into much more trouble than any of them did for some reason. I found out later they were the smart ones. But, you know, I don't know. They at least they, you know, they did better than me. But some of them came in later, too, so into AA. So I don't know. It is what it is. For me, it was all about the stories as well. you know, and a teenager and a young man. It was all about the stories. And so I was very used to telling stories of drinking stuff that would happen to me, you know. And I never included in the stories that sometimes when I got home at about, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I would fall asleep for an hour or two, I would sometimes wake up and I could not exist. I could not drink. I could not be sober. I felt I could not be. So what I did at that time, I thought my mother was just the most idiot. She was just the most bourgeois, idiotic person there was. I just hated her, detested her, and I let her know. You know, she's a frail, like a small woman, kind of, you know, like up to here. And I was this size when I was about 16, something like that. And so I used to really let her know that through different actions and sometimes be very threatening. But I would wake up this stupid, bourgeois, idiotic woman at about 5 a.m., sometimes 6 a.m. in the morning, and she needed to hold me for a couple hours because I couldn't exist. I never included that in the story I told the guys afterwards. I didn't. Yes, and then we did this, and then and this, and yes, and then I come home and my mom rocked me to sleep for 2 hours. Never like that. Never included in the story. I've since found out that I'm not the only one who does this, you know. Later on, we often use pharmaceuticals. So one of the toughest guys I've sponsored back home in Iceland, who was like a scary drug dealer kind of a dude, he used to take a lot of benzodiazepines so he could fall asleep. Because in that space, he could not exist either, you know. Interesting. So I finally ended up getting kicked out of my house, my mom. Probably the runner-up in the Scandinavian kind of codependency contest. Maybe number 3 or number 2, something like that, in Scandinavia for codependency. I was big enough of an asshole for a long enough time that even she kicked me out of the house. And if anything speaks volumes to how difficult I was, it's that she ended up kicking me out of the house. That is just amazing. My grandfather that she grew up with was an alcoholic. Then she met a wonderful man, my father, who she moved in with after living with my alcoholic grandfather. Well, my father was also an alcoholic. Then my father left and she had 7 years with no alcoholic in the house or in her life. And then I came along and started drinking as well. You know, 6, 7 years. So at that point, she had had 6 years with no active alcoholism in her life, and she was 40, you know. But I still managed to carry it far enough that she went and sought help. And the thing was, she really wanted me to get help. So she said, go to a psychiatrist, go to a psychologist, there's something seriously wrong with you. And because I didn't have a problem, she was the crazy one, right? She ended up going instead of me. Which is a good thing, right? Because she was the crazy person. But the problem is one of these people told her to kick me out, and she ended up doing that. So, and I was in a position where I could really drink for some time. I was staying with some people, and I was in a position where I could continue drinking. But I just had this moment of clarity. You know, I just sincerely believed that I needed to stop, you know, that the Russian roulette I'd been playing, there were just no more empty chambers. I just could not drink again. And I don't know why that happened to me at that age, at that time. You know, that's, for me now, it's just grace. It's my higher power kicking in, you know. The big thing is that I got the desperation needed to seek help, you know. But I just kind of sought help on the side. I tried to stay sober on my own for a little while, and then I went into treatment. And I ended up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had a gymnasium exam, I felt I was the most educated person in Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? I was pretty special, you know. So I sat in the rooms and I've read a lot of books, which always makes you very smart, right? Reading books, oh, always very smart. So I I felt I was so smart. And I sat in the rooms and I knew everything, you know. And I was totally, my head was totally shaved, and I was in this big trench coat all the time and these kind of old-looking clothes. And I sat like this and with a face like somebody had tried to attack my mom yesterday and, you know, thought I was a tough guy because I was on probation. I was a tough guy, right? It's beautiful. It's adorable. But that's what I believed at the time. And so, and and the only thing that really got me to change in the rooms was some pain. That's what I needed, you know. And I needed pain to learn to say two things. First of all, I needed to say, I don't know. I was dying from always knowing everything, right? Sitting in these rooms, if I'm constantly telling myself that I know everything, there's no room for new data. There is no room for new information. I have to realize that I don't know. I have to realize there is space for new data. I have to realize that there's a different way to do things. But it wasn't like that for me in the beginning. I knew everything. I sat in these rooms and I listened to grinning idiots like myself talk, and that's what I thought. You know, it's an idiot, I know everything. So pain, desperation in the rooms taught me to say, I don't know. Another thing I really didn't like to say, and which pain taught me to say in these rooms, is help me. I do not like to say help me. That means I'm weak. That means I can't do everything. That means I possibly don't know everything either. Oof, yeah, it's bad. So I needed to say, help me, you know. And it took some time for me to do that. So I got sober January 12, 1999, and it was in August of 1999 that I finally sought the help I needed. What I did is there were these evil people that were working the steps. Can you imagine that? And they were talking about God in an AA meeting. God in an AA meeting? How inappropriate is that? That's vulgar. That's like taking you off your clothes in an AA meeting, talking about God in an AA meeting. And so I went to this meeting because these people had something that I did not have. It was just obvious to me. They had sobriety and they had peace of mind. And that's what I needed. there's a good friend of mine who used to say, he probably stole it from someplace else. That's why in AA it's called sharing, not stealing, right? He said, the same man drinks again. If I don't change, I will drink again. And I was not changing. And I knew the obsessive thoughts were coming back, and I knew I was drinking again. And being the sensitive type I am, I was scared shitless what would happen if I would drink again. So in August 1999, I went to this meeting, and I asked for a sponsor. And I didn't really care who it was. But I really liked it to be a special person. Because I'm a unique alcoholic. I am. I mean, I'm smarter than the average alcoholic, right? Better educated with my gymnasium exam, right? Right, you know? So I needed a special alcoholic. And I got a very special alcoholic. He looked like a complete idiot. Very unfashionable. He had this big grin that was just, you know, made him look like, ugh, I don't know what. And he used to wear these big belts with a belt buckle. And this was 1990. Nobody wore that. Oh, my God. You know, it was just horrible. And these lively Hawaiian shirts, you know, and he was not being ironic about it. He actually thought they were cool sincerely. It was not a hipster thing for him. It's just horrible. So this lowly person, right, because I was at that place, he took me through the steps, you know. And it's so amazing that I was in pain enough and I was scared enough to actually do the work. So basically what we did, with some minor alterations, was that we took the big book and we read it. Whenever the big book told us to do something, we did it. This is a revolutionary new method in Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened for me is that slowly I started to change, you know, and I started to change in this fellowship. At the same time, in August of 1999, I started to attend men's meetings. And those were kind of cool guys. And I remember first time I came to the meeting, I was scared that they would turn me down. They would say, oh, we don't take your kind there. Right? And so at the same time, I felt I was better and smarter than everybody else. And I also felt I was a piece of shit and worse than everybody else, and they would reject me. Isn't that interesting? Are you familiar with that feeling at the same time? Yeah. A megalomaniac with an inferiority complex. That's what that's called, right? You've heard that before? Yeah. Yes, yes, exactly. So I'm both better than you, way better than you, but I'm also way worse than you. Very it's an interesting place to be at. So I was at this interesting place, and I remember asking to... If they needed, you know, they needed somebody to do the coffee, and I asked if I could do it, and I was sure they would say no, but they didn't. They always went to a meeting after the meeting. They went out to eat afterwards. They still go to the same place, by the way. Almost 16 years later, they still go to the same place. 15 years later, and it's not because of the food. And I asked if I could go to meeting after the meeting, or they invited me to the meeting after the meeting. And so at that time, that was a big help me thing for me too, because I was so special. I was so unique, and I was so better than everybody else that I could never belong to anything, right? So when I was growing up, people were, you know, had these groups that were kind of having fun and, you know, and I just thought those people were idiots. I never felt I belonged in any group like that, you know. And I'm not saying that's a part of being an alcoholic. I'm just saying that's a part of my personality and my story. You know, maybe you can identify with it. But I asked to be a part of something, and I was willing to do that. And I needed a lot of suffering to get to that place, you know, because that means I had to let go of some of the things that made me so much better than everybody else, right? I had to let go of that distance I had between me and everybody else. I had to let go of the strong, silent type thing I was doing, you know, because I was a man with a dark past. Seriously, 20 years old? Yeah. This is what I believed. When I see dudes that look like me today, I just give them like a 10-minute hug. I'm just like, can I get over here? And they never come back again. I don't understand why. So I went through the steps with this sponsor, and the miracle happens between 1 and 12. For me, it happened at 12. You know, it really started to happen. It was one revolutionary thing that happened for me is that I started greeting new people in meetings. Do you know that people actually do that? Isn't that shocking? You know, in Iceland, in the AA I was in the beginning, you treated the newcomer as he had leprosy. Because then you were testing, right? That was the excuse. You were testing if he was serious enough to be in AA. So if he still came and we treated him like shit for a few months and he still kept on coming, then he was serious about coming. What a cunning plan. Strange that those meetings don't grow a lot, isn't it? Very strange. Not that I'm judging it. If people want to do that, that's fine. So these guys in this meeting, they actually greeted newcomers. And for me, the two most foul words in the entire Icelandic language are perky and open, like being open. For me, those are the two most foul swear words you could find. Like being a warm person, that's the worst thing you can say about anybody, right? Being warm and open, disgusting, disgusting. And so, But I became that. That's what AA has done to me. Right? Some people even say I'm warm and open today. But that's what I had to do. I had to let go of that old persona, right? The guy who was tough, whatever. The guy who was alone and everybody was an idiot. And I really felt strongly that most of the people in society were just useless pieces of meat. And those are the exact words I used about the population at large. I just thought they were useless pieces of meat. That's what I said. It's kind of not a loving or cuddly person. And so I had to let go of that. And so a big thing for me was to greet new people. And I didn't have to say anything smart. And I didn't have to say anything life-changing. I just had to say welcome. Because that did a lot for me. When somebody came up to me, and I was hoping they were going to say something mean so I could say something mean back. And they smiled and they said, welcome. I had no smart ass answer to that. You know? In AA, we disarm each other with kindness. Because that's the only weapon that really works on alcoholics, you know? That's the only thing that worked on me, really. You know? They were just kind to me in the beginning. They saw who I was and they were just kind. Yeah, sure. Welcome. Yeah, great. You know, they didn't fight me a lot, you know, because I just wasn't at the place that where I could handle that, because that's what I expected from them. That's what I was. Do you know what I mean? I was geared for that. I didn't expect the kindness bit. Anyway, I started to do this with newcomers. And soon I started to give out my phone number to newcomers, and they started to call me. And in the beginning, I did a lot of meetings, I did a lot of service work, and I read the doctor's opinion 15 times in a row. And the reason is because all the guys I started to work with only came and met me once. Then they found somebody else to read the big book with. So I was at the place, you know, where I often would just start reading in chapter 3. I didn't care. I was just so bored with the doctor's opinion, I would just start at chapter 3 to get, you know, a change in pace. But the beautiful thing about service work, about the 12th step, is that I do not get paid by results in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And this is my favorite joke. I tell it all the time. In the United States, people get very offended. It's interesting to see what will happen now. But doing the 12-step is like being a government employee. You do not have to show any results. You just have to show up. Always, there's always three people after it speak who wait, and I think they're going to tell me how great I am. And they're like, what is it about you and government employees? Don't you know how hard we work? Yes, I know. It's just a joke. Or I can say, oh, it's about Icelandic people. When I'm in the United States, I say, oh, it's about Danish people. So that's the beautiful thing. I have to do my best, of course, but I don't have to get any results. Like now, today, I'm speaking here, and it does not really matter what you get out of it, really. I would love if you would love it. That would be awesome for me. You know, I would prefer that, of course. But the fact is, I am doing my very best right now, and that's all I have to do. You know, and that's what I get paid for in Alcoholics Anonymous, giving it my best. You know, and that's very good, because often there are no results. You know, guys that I work with relapse all the time. But guys that I work with stay sober all the time as well, you know. But, you know, again, for me, it's just about doing the work. I had a period in my sobriety where I was very insecure about how much AA I was doing, if I was doing enough AA, how I was doing it, all that stuff. So what I did, of course, is I created an Excel spreadsheet. Like any person would do, right? And I printed it out, and I put a few things on it. And I said, you know, I put You know, work the 12 step, go to a meeting. For me, I had issues with taking a shower for some reason. So I said, taking a shower, and then morning meditation, and then evening meditation. So I marked those things down, and I did that for 4 years, you know. And what I found out, that if I consistently did the 12th step, the rest of my list looked really good. If that top thing with the 12th step was empty, the rest was usually empty as well. That was my scientific experiment, right? That's enough data for me. Again, just my experience, you know? So from that, I know, and remember, I'm not counting how many days guys I was talking to were staying sober. I was counting how much time I was feebly trying to help somebody else, right? Very imperfectly, but I was trying my best. So I've been very fortunate in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've gotten to try many different things. What I do know is that I cannot stay sober myself, and I have realized just what kind of alcoholic I am. I am this special kind of alcoholic who will drink again. You know? I was thinking about this one a few years ago, and I thought, what kind of alcoholic drinks again? What kind is it? Oh, it's the kind like me that drinks again, you know? I truly believe I'm the alcoholic who will drink again if I do not do what I need to do. I also believe that I do not have to drink again. I believe I can choose whether I drink or not. And I do not do that by choosing the drink and saying yes or no. I do that by being here tonight. This is my choice of not drinking. And that's the complicated thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes when we're sitting at the table with a drink, it's too late to decide not to drink. Sometimes the obsession is so strong at that point that we do no longer have a choice. And that's the scary thing for me about alcoholism. Cunning, baffling, powerful, you know, they say in the English book, in the American Big Book. And that's the best way to describe it. So I choose not to drink, and I'm not saying I'm guaranteed or anything. I'm just saying that's how I can do my best, you know. So I choose not to drink by being here. I choose not to drink by going on the men's retreat. I choose not to drink by doing all the things I've been doing for the last 15 years and 7 or 8 months, you know. That's how I choose not to drink. And I do that because I don't want to be faced with a choice where I don't have a choice anymore, you know? What I also found out, and I sincerely believe, that I need the power that propels the universe to keep me sober. I need the power that propels the universe to keep me sober. I cannot stay sober by myself. I need a higher power, you know? How I cultivate that relationship, mostly, and the big book suggests this, I just do a lot, thy will be done. You know, the big book talks about this both under the 10th step and the 11th step. They say the same thing, right? And they mention this a lot of times in the book, saying, thy will be done, not mine. And so I do a lot of that. But I have spiritual amnesia. I forget that I'm supposed to do that all the time. I don't know if it's because I'm an idiot or because I have spiritual amnesia. I try to choose that I have spiritual amnesia. So I forget that I'm supposed to do that. So a lot of the work I do in AA is not really to help me remember that I'm an alcoholic, because I can't remember that myself. Only God can help me remember that as I understand him. But it's to remember that I need God. And to give me the power to stay close to him. I know the things I need to do today, most of the time, to stay close to that energy I choose to call God. Higher power as I understand it. But the things I know I need to do, I don't do. Unless I'm doing this program, you know. And for me, I need a fellowship for my spirituality. The big book in the 11th step, they talk about, you know, belonging to religious organizations and we're doing whatever spiritual stuff. And that's all awesome. You know, people do that. That's fine. AA does not have an opinion about that. I have not really gotten into anything like that. My spirituality is my fellowship. My spiritual fellowship is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that means I have to do quite a bit of AA, though, to keep me there. Because if I don't, I just forget. I just forget. No, it's nothing personal. I just forget. All the time I forget. I am at the place now where I'm, as I said, I got sober in 1999 and I moved to Minneapolis, Minnesota in 2006. When I moved, I had to start over again. You know, nobody knew how awesome I was in Minneapolis. In Minneapolis, 8 years of sobriety is like warm up to sobriety. You haven't really begun. You're just kind of warming up to getting sober, you know. And there's a lot of people there with more than 40 years. The oldest Alano club functioning in the world is in Minneapolis. They have a lot of history. They have a lot of treatment centers. There's a lot of strength in AA there. The AA there has old bones. And it was very powerful to belong to a fellowship like that. But as I said, they didn't know how awesome I was. So I had to go to a lot of meetings, read the doctor's opinion a lot, sometimes starting in chapter 3 again. I'm not going to read the doctor. Why are we starting in the middle of the book? Don't worry about that. Just read. Go into a lot of institutions and a lot of coming to meetings and seeking out the dude who looked like I feel. Seeking out that guy who looked like I looked like in 1999, you know. And then saying, hey, welcome. Welcome to AA. How's it going? In America, when you ask how's it going, you're just saying hi, by the way. They don't really care how it's going. Just some cultural education here. It's very complex in the beginning. Well, that's a good question. Let me tell you. And they're like, oh my God, what's going on? Or how are you? It's the same thing. That means hello. It took me like 2 years to realize that. But eventually, this doing the same thing that I did before worked. Okay? I didn't need to drink. And slowly, the fellowship came up around me. Or I came into the fellowship, however you want to see it. And I have a lot of excellent friends and strong fellowship in Minneapolis, too. You know, a lot of good people there, good guys I work with. My sponsor is there. My sponsor, he has two good things going for him. First, he got sober one day before I was born, which was good. Second of all, he's partly deaf, which is also very helpful. Because a lot of what he does when he can't hear is he will laugh. And then he will say, that's great, Court. Because my name is Court in Alcoholics Anonymous in America. That's great. And I know when he says that's great, he did not understand what I was saying. Either because of my accent or his deafness. But that's a good sponsor for me. And then he'd say, have you tried talking to God about it? Oh, yeah. And then I say, oh, thank you. And I hang up the phone. And he sponsors me in a way that I believe, how can I say this? He sponsors me in a way that I try to sponsor other people in, that I do not believe what's called in Minneapolis or the States, CEO sponsorship. CEO just stands for Chief Executive Officer, right? Chairman of the board. He does not believe in that kind of sponsorship, and I don't either. I do not believe as a sponsor that I have the data, that I have the information to make decisions in your life. Should you or should you not quit your job? I don't know. I do not have the data to make that decision. Should you or should you not date this man or this woman? I don't know. I do not have the data to make that decision. Should you or should you not make your bed in the morning? I don't know. I do not have the data to make that decision for you. I just sincerely believe that people there are so many things that come into decisions. There are so many things that matter when we make choices. I believe that's just none of my affair. As a sponsor, my job is to share experience and directions how to get close to God and stay close to God as we understand it. That's it. That's my job. My job is not to make decisions in other people's life. I would love for it to be that way. Don't misunderstand me. I would love for it to be the dude with the nipples in the air in a big sofa and saying, yeah, do that, and yeah, don't do that, and sell it 300. But I tried that, and it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Because if I start making decisions, then, you know, in the beginning, I'm responsible for good stuff that happens. Whee! And then I get responsible for bad stuff that happens. And that's not so fun, you know. And so that's not how I sponsor. I sponsor by just giving my experience, you know. Experience, strength, and hope, basically. And that's what's worked for me. And as I've kind of touched on in this speak up until this point, I am kind of into, I think working with others really helps. I do think that. And often I think it's the best kept hidden secret in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? I would have never thought to do that if I did not have a fellowship of men that taught me to do that. And not taught by saying it, but taught by doing it. Taught by doing it to me and then with me. You know? But there's really nothing that works as well. And I'm just going to finish with this, that in December, my my mom passed away. You know? And I'd been sober for almost, you know, 15 years at that point, and I had made as much amends to her as I could, you know. And she was very happy with me, very proud of me. I actually ended up, and we leave titles and all that shit out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do believe in that. But I did end up with a very kind of like with a doing really well in the field that she had chosen for her profession, I can say. And she was very proud of me for that, you know. And so the amends that I could make, I had already made. But she passed on, and I was on my way from Minneapolis to Reykjavik, and I was in Boston at the time when I got the call that she had passed. And I went into, you know, I had a moment in a church somewhere, and where I said my goodbyes, and then I landed, and you know, and there was it was a really tough time, and I had an incident where somebody said something wrong, you know, and offended me. Can you believe that they offended me? Bastards. And I had a tidal wave of resentment, you know. And of course, I was vulnerable. I was messed up, you know. And what I did is I couldn't sleep for resentment, you know. I just lay there like that for 4 hours, thinking about it, like this, you know. Finally fell asleep, and I was getting really messed up, and I needed to be in a good place. You know, it was a big funeral, a lot of stuff going on, family there, you know how it is. And I get a text message, and I'm just newly in the country. I get a text message. There's this guy I'd sponsored 5 years ago, relapsed in September, and had no idea any of this was going on, just saw on Facebook that I was back in the country. I said, shit, I'm willing to stop drinking again. Can you help? And I was like, with capital letters, fuck, yeah. Can we meet now? And so that's what we did. 8:30 a.m. in a coffee shop. You know, I met with him, and he had no idea about my mom. He had no clue. I didn't even mention at that time, you know. I just knew that that's what I needed to do to get through this. And that's the guy who carried me through that time, you know. This dude who had no idea he was carrying me through that time, you know. He actually thought I was helping him. Isn't that adorable? And this is how the 12-step works for me again and again and again. I have to be sincere about it. I have to do my best. But there's magic in it that I can't find in other things. And maybe that's just for me, but that's my experience and that's all I can give. Anyway, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for listening. Thank you for inviting me to the retreat. It's been a life-changing experience. So thank you so much.